This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a look at the threat posed by white supremacist ideology following the mosque massacre in Christchurch, New Zealand. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Brenton Tarrant, a 28-year-old Australian, was charged with 50 counts of murder and 39 counts of attempted murder in the March 15 bloodshed at two mosques in the city of Christchurch. It was the deadliest mass shooting in New Zealand's history and one of the worst cases of right-wing terrorism in years. Tarrant allegedly stormed the two houses of worship during midday prayers and shot dozens of huddling and fleeing worshippers while live-streaming the killings over social media with a body-mounted camera. This act of terror against Muslims, along with the Pittsburgh synagogue killings last year and the deadly neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, are ringing alarm bells regarding the growing menace of white supremacist ideology. According to the Anti-Defamation League, in 2018, every single extremist killing in the United States had a link to right-wing or white supremacist ideology. In contrast, jihadist terrorism is at an all-time low. On this edition of Encounter, we talk with two experts about the attacks in New Zealand and what they say about the rise of the white power movement. First, we turn to Kathleen Belew. She is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And Kathleen Belew joins us by phone from Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Kathleen, first let me get your reaction to the massacre in New Zealand and how that relates to your research on the white power movement.
So I study the white power movement largely in the United States in the period of its formation from the Vietnam War to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. But within that period, the movement is, first of all, organizing in a very transnational way and beginning to form these connections with activists in other places, and is also creating sort of an ideological apparatus that we then see emerge in acts like Christchurch. So right away, from the messages written on the gunmen's weapons and magazines to the manifesto to even, I saw a story this week that he had posted a death threat to someone on Facebook 2 years before the attack, all of these directly reference the white power movement in the United States and therefore can be understood by using that earlier history.
That's interesting. So he really harks back to the movement here in the United States.
Yes. And I should say, too, that that movement is very transnational in nature. It was influenced very heavily by inflows of ideologies like British Israelism and also by skinhead culture that arrived in the United States from Great Britain in the late 1980s. But it's also sort of a crucible of formation for what becomes a white power movement that really activates on a transnational or international scale and seeks to unite activists in countries that are seen by the movement with enough white people to create a white world in some utopian future, which include Europe, South Africa, the United States, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand.
What do you think are the main factors that are fueling this movement now? We're seeing an uptick in crimes motivated by this ideology, discrimination against minorities, whether African Americans, Jews, Muslims. What's going on? What are some of the factors you think are fueling this?
So it's really interesting to look at this earlier history, because the last time this group of activists turned to sort of open warfare on the state, which is how I would characterize much of the violence that we're seeing now, was in a moment that was very similar contextually. So a moment of a long post-war with dissatisfaction about the experience of warfare, a moment of economic precarity, a moment of rising anti-immigration sentiment, and a moment of executive power that, you know, the center might see to be right-wing, but people on the fringe see to be evidence that electoral politics cannot deliver the kind of changes that they are looking for, and therefore they have to turn to this revolutionary guerrilla war-style activism.
Let's take a look at reactions to this horrific massacre, first by the New Zealand government, and we also have a reaction from the White House. How do you assess the way in which the New Zealand government reacted and responded to this massacre?
So I should say again that I'm a historian and my expertise is in the United States in this earlier period. But I will say that at no point in the United States' reaction to white power violence at any level has there been anything like what we see now in New Zealand. There's no point when there is a big court case that returns a bunch of verdicts that really hobble the movement. There's no point when there is a sustained public discourse that really brings to bear the full weight of public understanding and opposition on this kind of a thing. And I think that's very different that we see now in and around Christchurch and in New Zealand more broadly, that the community is interested in learning about what this is and what it means to the community and how they might stop it. I find a lot of hope in that.
In contrast, President Donald Trump here in the United States offered condolences, but he says that he does not believe white nationalism is a growing global danger and that the suspects belong to more of a small group of people that have very, very serious problems. Do you agree with that? Is that an accurate portrayal of the problem?
That's a point of view that's not unique to our president. I think many people understand this as the work of a fringe movement or a few bad apples or crazy people. The thing that's really clear, though, from studying the earlier history is how many ordinary people get taken up in this activism. And for certain, it is a fringe movement. It's very difficult to know how big it is right now for a number of reasons. But in the period that I study in the 80s, what we're talking about is a very, very small group of people. And it helps to think about this as sort of concentric circles of membership. So in the middle, right, hardcore activists who have their whole lives in this movement, we're only talking about like 25,000 people. And then outside of that, there's a larger ring of an additional 100,000 to 175,000 people. And those people sort of go to rallies, buy the literature, and have a less formal but still ideological stake in white power activism. And then outside of that, there's another 450,000 people who don't themselves buy the newspapers, but who regularly read the newspapers. So we might imagine that there's additional rings outside of those, right, where there would be a larger still group of people who would never pick up a newspaper that says official paper of the Knights of the KKK, but who might read and agree with the stories in one if they were presented in some other way. And this model of concentric circle organization works to move people both from the outside into that radicalized inner circle, and it also pushes ideas from that inner circle out into mainstream political discourse. So while it is a fringe movement, it's one that's had enormous impact on politics and life in the United States. One example of this is the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which killed 168 people. That is the largest deliberate mass casualty event on American soil between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. But people in the United States still don't have a narrative about what it was. It's still understood as the action of one or a few people, rather than as part of a wide-ranging social movement that connected activists in all regions of the country and that has never really been stopped.
And of course, there's the role of social media, which magnifies and amplifies these sentiments and brings together like-minded people around the world. We know that Brenton Tarrant actually filmed this heinous act, and this was posted on social media until it was taken down, but it was circulated around the world, and messages also. So that must fuel and motivate like-minded killers.
I think that's right. And it's important to remember, too, that although this viral body-mounted camera is new and horrific in Christchurch, the role of social media is very, very familiar to this movement. And in fact, these groups got on their kind of pre-internet message boards as early as 1983-84 in a network called LibertyNet. And what they posted there was not just assassination lists. It also included things like personal ads and recipes. So effectively, what they were doing is pioneering social network activism way before the invention of Facebook. They are generations into using this technology to band together, to circumvent laws that attempt to stop the spread of hate literature and to motivate violence.
And we should also look at the role of governments and law enforcement. Do you think that here in the United States and other parts of the world have ignored the rise of white supremacist ideology and the actions, the violent actions that flow from it, but we're not seeing concomitant ways to combat it or prevent it.
I think that's absolutely right. And I speculate that it is in part because there has been such deep misunderstanding of what this is. When they're understood as the work of lone wolves or even a few bad apples, what we get is a response that is coordinated towards individual issues. Instead of looking at what I would now describe as a wave of white power violence, for instance, if we think about the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue is anti-Semitic violence, the attack in Christchurch is Islamophobic violence, and even just to look at only the last 6 months, the arrest of the Coast Guard officer who had assassination lists and a plan to kill political enemies as political violence, what we get are three separate stories, right? And three separate prosecutions, three separate events. And I mean, they are acts of anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and political violence, but they're also all joined by white power symbology, ideology, ties, and discourse. And when we put them together, that really changes how we might approach this, because then the story would be about a wave of white power violence. It's very, very evident that this is on the rise and a serious threat to our democracy. And it's imperative that society do the work of figuring out how to address it.
Kathleen Belew is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. We're discussing the rise of white supremacist ideology in the wake of a spate of violence flowing from it, such as the recent shootings at the two New Zealand mosques. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Dr. Radia Ishak from Sana'a, Yemen. For another perspective on the fallout from the New Zealand massacres and the audacity of extremist white nationalist groups who have violently attacked Jews, Muslims, and people of color in the United States and abroad, we turn to Ali Soufan, who joins us by phone from New York City. He's a former supervisory FBI agent and the CEO of the Soufan Group. That's an international strategic consulting firm based in New York City. Ali, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Carol.
Ali, we spoke with Professor Kathleen Belew about the origins of the white power movement in the United States and the fact that it's become a transnational movement. I'd like to get your view of how much of a threat do you think white supremacist ideology is to Western democracy, whether here in the United States or abroad?
Well, today we see a rise of white nationalist or right-wing extremists, not only in the United States, but in Western societies. For example, you see in Germany just last year attacks by these kind of groups, about 60%. In England, there was an 88% increase in attacks and in plots connected to right-wing extremists and other hate groups. In the United States, the numbers are striking. In the last 10 years, according to the ADL, about 73% of the victims of terrorism were because of attacks conducted by white supremacists. For example, we look at jihadi Islamic terrorism. The number is probably about 23%. So it is a big threat. It's a network that was always there, but now we start to see it more organized. And also, at the same time, we start to see some transnational coordination happening, very similar to what happened with the Islamists back in the 90s.
And Ali, why do you think the world pays less attention to this threatening terror group, white nationalists, than, for example, Islamist terrorists? It appears that even President Trump is eager to highlight attacks and hate crimes perpetrated by Muslims, but has been much slower and less forceful when Muslims are the victims or if the act is perpetrated by a white supremacist.
There are so many reasons for that, and politics is definitely number one. The rise of this movement is connected to the rise of ultranationalist politics across of Europe and even here in the United States. So we don't have a political agreement on coming up with a strategy to counter the threats posed by this kind of hate groups. It becomes a political issue domestically, and as it is in so many countries around Western Europe, if you look, for example, at the recent elections in Europe, you see that there is an overlap between right-wing extremism and between nationalistic politics. Far-right parties have made significant gains in many Western European countries. So there are political elements for that. But also at the same time, you know, after 9/11, our whole counterterrorism and counterintelligence apparatus to focus on terrorist networks around the world is basically built and tailored to focus on the jihadis, not on other groups. And, you know, I don't think intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies have the legal authority to focus on domestic terror groups in the same way that they focus on foreign terrorist organizations. And that legal authority makes it a little bit complicated to monitor and to collect on right-wing extremists, the same way we collect and we monitor Islamic jihadists.
So we are still allocating a disproportionate number of resources and efforts to combat Islamist terror, which is actually declining relative to the kind of terror we're seeing emanating from white nationalists.
Sure, but I don't think we should forget about Islamic terrorism. It's still there. It's very dangerous. You know, ISIS is basically just the transforming from a proto-state to an underground terrorist organization. Al-Qaeda is stronger than ever. So we need to keep focusing on that, but also at the same time, we need to pay attention to this other network that is growing in plain sight. Other European countries are paying very good attention to it. For example, MI5 was tasked in taking over intelligence gathering and tracking these kind of right-wing extremist groups in the same way they do with the Islamic jihadists. In Germany, more funding and more resources were giving to Department 2 of Germany's Federal Domestic Intelligence Agency, the BND, to track right-wing extremists. In the United States, I think the FBI and the different joint terrorism task forces across the United States are doing phenomenal job in tracking the network, but they track it as a criminal network, not as part of an overall counterterrorism strategy because of mainly legal considerations. But in the first quarter of this year, way more people connected to hate groups were arrested and plots were disrupted rather than with the jihadis. So law enforcement intelligence doing phenomenal work domestically here in the United States. Our partners in Europe, especially in Germany and the UK, are doing a great job in monitoring that threat. And I think legally over there, they don't differentiate between domestic terrorism and international terrorism. Terrorism is terrorism in Europe. Unfortunately, in the United States, there is a big legal difference between domestic terrorism and international terrorism. It's easy to initiate an international terrorism case, and it's easy to file charges under international terrorism. With domestic terrorism, it is a lot more complicated, and frankly, we don't even have severe penalties associated with such a charge, domestic terrorism. If you look at the synagogue shooter, for example, he is prosecuted on criminal charges, not on terrorism charges. So I think there will be a need at one point to look into the legal component of this fight against hate groups in the United States.
Let's turn now to actual similarities between white nationalist groups and jihadist killers. The two groups obviously detest each other, yet they share methods, morals, and mindsets.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. Talk about the similar strategies and tactics between Islamist jihadists and ultranationalist white supremacists who are motivated by racial and religious animus.
Both of them are hate networks, and they feed off each other. You know, every time an Islamic terrorist does an attack, the right-wing extremists will benefit from it, and every time the right-wing extremists attack a Muslim, the Salafi jihadist terrorist benefits from it. Ironically, there are striking similarities, not only in ideology, but also in strategy and recruitment. Both right-wing extremists and Islamic jihadis, for example, increasingly utilize social media in order to spread their ideology and in order order to recruit more members. They advocate a pure and military lifestyle. The jihadis want pure religious society. Right-wing extremists want a pure ethnic society. Violence is the key for both of them. Anarchy, violence, lone wolf actions, all meant to disrupt the society and to disrupt the order of things. There are similarities in this way, but also both of them emphasize utilizing all these political and social divisions that we have in our societies, all these cultural wars, in order to blend in order to become more mainstream and achieve their goals. And finally, I think we started to see them cultivating a global network, and we start to see the right-wing extremists doing exactly what the jihadis did with the transnational movement. We started to see that with the right-wing extremists going to Ukraine and taking sides in the conflict in Ukraine. Ukraine is that vacuum that they need in order to train and to connect with others. They are very different in their views, in their ideas, in which group they hate the most, Jews or the Muslims or the immigrants. So there is a lot of differences among these groups, and they are not monolithic at this point in any way, shape, or form.
And you made reference to the use of social media that both extremist groups use. Should there be a more concerted effort to scrub the internet of hate speech and propaganda emanating from these violent white nationalist sources?
This is something that we've been talking about for a long time, not only about the white supremacists and the hate groups, but also with the Islamists and the jihadis, and also with fake news and the disinformation campaigns. And I think the social media companies can do more and more, but also this is a very complicated subject, and I think social media companies can sometimes be limited in how they monitor and how they control their own platforms. But definitely, we need to pay attention to hate speech on these platforms, because it's creating a lot of chaos and divisions, and it's actually recruiting people who have identity issues. And these groups, the Islamists or the neo-Nazis and white supremacists, are coming to these individuals and saying, hey, you know what, we can give you the solution. We can show you a world that you didn't know it exists. And unfortunately, that's going to create a lot of instability down the road.
It's a problem that we're going to have to be monitoring and seeing if we can prevent this terrible trend.
Sure. I mean, we need to monitor it. We need to have a discussion about this. We need to come up with a strategy to counter domestic terrorism here in the United States. And we need to figure out a way how we coordinate with our allies. What we've seen in Christchurch, I believe, is unfortunately only the beginning. You have a guy from Australia committing a terrorist attack in New Zealand, listening to songs about a war criminal from Bosnia, writing the names of white supremacists and neo-Nazis on his rifle, and wearing a logo from the Azov battalion in Ukraine. I mean, this is something very concerning, and we know that we have groups in the United States who also went to Ukraine, trained in Ukraine, and came back to the United States to conduct violence in our society. The FBI, for example, recently indicted 4 members of a group called Rise Above Movement, who were involved in violent activities during the Charlottesville demonstrations. And those guys, they are neo-Nazis, and they also went to Ukraine. They fought in Ukraine and trained in Ukraine and came back in order to create problems and chaos in the United States. And it reminds me in the 80s and the early 90s when the FBI and other intelligence and law enforcement groups here in the United States were saying, pay attention to these jihadis. And nobody wanted to pay attention in the government, because at the time we thought the jihadis were our friends, and they went and they fought the Soviets in Afghanistan, and we don't have to worry about them. And look what happened in 1993 with the World Trade Center bombing, and then later on with the USS Cole and with the East Africa Embassy bombings, and with 9/11. And look at the world today, because of a threat that we did not squash really early when it came out. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing this network evolving, but there is no political will to face it and counter it appropriately.
Ali Soufan is a former FBI agent and the CEO of the Soufan Group. Once again, I'd like to thank my guests, Kathleen Belew, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Chicago and the author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America, and Ali Soufan, former supervisory FBI agent and the CEO of the Soufan Group. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.